how is our flag allowed to be hijacked with the narrative of empire and colonialism? That was the biggest far-right march there's ever been in this country on the streets very recently. And the Prime Minister and the political establishment don't seem to oppose it.
Coming back to the Labour Party conference, how do you think it's actually going to change Keir Starmer's policy on Gaza, the fact that the majority of his delegates have now voted saying that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide?
I sadly don't think it's going to change anything at all. We have the UN essentially saying that this is a genocide. We have genocide scholars saying it's a genocide. So with respect to Labour members who I think have made the right decision here, I think if Keir Starmer's not going to listen to some of the most established bodies in the world who are there to rule over this and to observe this, then he's not going to listen to his own members.
I think when there's a need for you to actually fly,
I guess when is there ever a need, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I mean, you have a long potential career in front of you.
That's true.
But yeah.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, I'll clap. Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. Today, I'm very glad to be out of the studio in this cafe with Zach Polansky. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I know you're a very busy person. It's going to be a long conversation. We're going to speak about Gaza. We're going to speak about the current state of UK politics. We're going to speak about the move to the far right, both in the UK and globally. You've obviously just recently won the leadership of the Green Party in a landslide election where 85% of your members voted for you. You've also just been ranked as one of the top 100 Time magazine people. So just begin with, how does that make you feel?
I mean, it feels absolutely amazing. And also, being really honest, it feels ridiculous. And I mean that in a good way. But I think about, say, my partner who works in palliative care and nurses, carers, teachers, cleaners, all the people who are doing amazing work in this country. I really want them to get recognition too. I suppose also in the same breath, I recognise that although I'm really pleased they've ranked me, what they're really ranking is the politics that I stand for, which is a compassionate politics, a politics of community, a politics of solidarity, a politics that is being bold about the things I stand for and bold about the things I stand against. And that's the Green Party. So although I'm really flattered and I love it, I also think it's really about what this moment is. And I think that's a politics that people can get behind.
Okay, so just to begin with, to kind of set the scene of what we're going to discuss, back in 2017, 2018, Steve Bannon, just after he had left the Trump White House, was running around Europe, kind of organizing the far right, kind of backing Nigel Farage. It's not like that was the moment of ascendancy for the far right. By then, already Farage had kind of cheerled the Brexit movement. Trump was already the president of the USA. But I mean, it was clear that the far right was organizing itself, was getting sort of motivated, and trying to make a big rush for it. How has that momentum kind of led us to this political moment and kind of informed the mandate that you have as the Green Party leader?
I think Brexit was patient zero for everything that's happened since. I also think the way the establishment responded to it was the very exact wrong way to respond to things. And what I mean by that is we had David Cameron and Nick Clegg going all over TV to tell everyone, don't worry, if you remain, everything will stay the same. And they didn't notice that lots of people in this country are incredibly disillusioned. They're tired and they're exhausted. They're not being paid properly. Their living standards are getting worse. And there's a real sense that politics is moving further and further away from them. So I think, first of all, it demonstrated the centrist or centre-right's complete failure to present an alternative vision that could excite most people in this country. Secondly, I think the lies and misinformation that were spun and the way that they talked about the bus with the number on it, and then they got everyone to keep repeating that number, that also demonstrated their ability to be able to tell powerful narratives. And I don't think the left have caught up as quickly as we need to in telling alternative narratives rather than just being in facts. Facts are really important, but actually if you don't hit people emotively, if you don't tell a story with the facts that connects with people, you're never really going to shift anything. And then I think finally, with Brexit, it was just that real sense of not talking about the issues that matter to people. So there was a real moment where there was a politician on stage talking about how this was going to improve GDP. And a member of the audience shouted, "Who's GDP? What does that even mean? That's going to benefit you, not me." And she was exactly right. The way that everything is measured in this country in terms of economic growth, in terms of growth of businesses, this doesn't matter to the mum who's a single parent. It doesn't matter to the young person who's just graduated and can't get a job or couldn't afford the university fees. It doesn't matter to the pensioner who's increasingly worried about their winter fuel allowance. So I think what Steve Bannon really clocked onto was an ability to connect to the everyday concerns of people and not offer solutions. In fact, the very solutions that him and Farage offer will make people's lives worse. They're toxic and they seek to divide people. But I think it showed an absence of narrative about what are the solutions we can make to connect to people's everyday lives. And that's why I put at the center of all of my politics absolute solidarity with minority communities, but not to get distracted by that, to always focus on reducing people's bills, on improving people's standard of living. And by the way, those same minority communities have it worse because of inequality. So all of these things are interconnected. But I think far too often we got distracted talking about the differences between communities rather than saying, actually, this is about the 99% versus the 1%. And we're here to share what we have in common and challenge wealth and power.
So, I mean, I opened with that question because it's got to do with organization. And it's also with what I think is the left's inability to organize historically, or recent history in the same way. Also yesterday, the Labour Party at their conference kind of voted against Keir Starmer on the motion of regarding Gaza. Majority of the delegates voted to say that they do regard Israel's actions in Gaza a genocide, a shocking move, quite frankly. And also that you know, the government should sanction arms sales against Israel. How does that vote kind of, what does it tell you about how politics is changing in the UK, in the Labour Party, and what does it mean for coalition building on the left and the Green Party?
Well, I think the right are always unified. So even when they have differences, they always seem to get it together. And it can sometimes feel to people in this country, especially when we think about the far right marches we've seen on our streets, that there are more people and we're outnumbered. We're not outnumbered, we're out-organized. And I think what we need to relentlessly do is look, how do we organize in our community spaces and get things together? In terms of coalition building, I was on a panel this week with Zara Sultana. I've done many panels with Jeremy Corbyn. They're two people I have a lot of time for. And in the same breath, what they're building does not exist yet. The Green Party has just hit 80,000 members. To put that in context, that's a 33% increase in membership since I launched my leadership campaign. And we are growing every single day. We got nearly 2 million votes and we've got 39 places where we're in second place. We're getting ready for our biggest set of local elections this May. We've been getting ready for those a long time. And in the general election, whenever it comes, we're ready to win more seats than we ever have before. So my argument to anyone, including Jeremy and Zara, would be if you want a party of environmental, social, racial, and economic justice, then join the Green Party. We're a socialist party, we're progressive, and we're democratic. It's one member, one vote. So sometimes people say to me sometimes, this niche thing they disagree with. And I go, that's fine, you don't have to agree with everything. Join the party and help change it. If you agree with me, you know, 9 out of 12 things, then that's great. If you agree with me on 12 out of 12 things, go see a psychiatrist, like that's a problem. And you know, of course there's red lines with that. We don't accept transphobia, misogyny, homophobia, racism. Those are things, you know, we're never gonna vote on. But if we're talking about policy and day-to-day lives, then we already have those mechanisms to change things. And so I don't think the left can afford to be split like this. Now, it's not my job to tell other people what to do. And if Jeremy and Zara want to do that, I have full respect for them. And my door's always open to keep having those conversations. But I'm not going to let go of what I think is the fundamental fact right now, that people are joining the Green Party in record numbers. We're winning elections in record numbers. We're getting defections from the Labour Party in record numbers. And we have an ability to speak to both people who have voted Labour in the past, Tory in the past, and indeed even Reform. And I think that makes us a unique coalition in of itself within a party. And I think that's something that no other party can do.
Coming back to the Labour Party conference, how do you think it's actually going to change Keir Starmer's policy on Gaza, the fact that the majority of his delegates have now voted saying that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide?
I sadly don't think it's going to change anything at all. We have the UN essentially saying that this is a genocide. We have genocide scholars saying it's a genocide. So with respect to Labour members who I think have made the right decision here, I think if Keir Starmer is not going to listen to some of the most established bodies in the world who are there to rule over this and to observe this, then he's not going to listen to his own members. We've also seen various examples throughout the last few years with Keir Starmer where the Labour membership have voted one way, I think proportional representation, for instance, where both the members and the trade union said, we don't want it to stay the same, we're going to vote differently, and then Keir Starmer has just unilaterally overruled them. That all being said, though, that doesn't mean it doesn't matter. I think it does matter to the Palestinians in the same way I've been on nearly all 30 of the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign marches, and journalists often say, well, they're not, you know, you're marching, but it's not stopping the genocide. What's the point? And I always think, well, the point is that people know that we're with them in solidarity. They see those videos and they see those images. And in what must be some of the darkest moments you could possibly imagine, to know that people on the other side of the world are out there marching for you, are campaigning for you, are speaking up for you, must be some relief, if not the amount of relief you need to stop a genocide.
So how significant is it?
I think it's significant to the Palestinians. I don't think it'll actually make a significant difference. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I think the Palestinians want to see solidarity. I've been on nearly all the 30 marches that Palestinian Solidarity Campaign have marched. And journalists often say to me, but it's not working, is it? What's the point? And I know the point is that people see those images and they see those videos. And in what must be some of the darkest moments, they have relief and solidarity in seeing those. But also, the UN have been very clear in terms of ruling around genocide. The ICJ, various genocide scholars have all talked about what's going on in Gaza to various lengths as a genocide. And so if Keir Starmer's not going to listen to some of the most esteemed scholars in the world who are experts on these subjects, a supposed human rights lawyer, I don't think he's going to listen to his own members. There's also examples where the members have voted on one thing, say proportional representation, for instance. The members have all voted one way, the trade unions have agreed, and then Keir Starmer's unilaterally gone, no, I don't agree with that. That doesn't strike me as a democratic party, but that's up for Labour members, not to me.
I asked the question specifically because it comes back to what you were saying earlier about coalition building, right? So it's clear that I'm not sure if Keir Starmer is going to last as the Labour leader, given that he's just, you know, not really listening to his membership, not listening to his party, and where that goes. And it also talks a lot. It also speaks to how politics in the UK has been captured by the elites, which we'll get to later. But just in terms of building a coalition, right? So it's clear that there's portions of Labour which are upset with their PM. This is despite the fact that Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana are making a different party. How do you see practically, and I know it's still the elections are still a long way out, but practically, how do you think the Green Party should start positioning itself to take advantage of all of this dissatisfaction with leadership that goes back to the Tories and that has come about because of the genocide in Gaza and other factors?
Yeah, again, in terms of coalition building, it is positive that people are speaking about a genocide. That's positive, whether it's in a political party, whether it's in a trade union, whether it's a community street event. I think people having eyes on Gaza and the flotilla that's making its way at the moment, these are all important conversations. So in terms of coalition building, again, to not be churlish, whether they're in my party or another party, I support any action that is about people at least talking about it. The next question, though, is what are you going to do about it? Of course, we need to stop selling arms to Israel. We need to stop sharing intelligence. We need to recognize this as an apartheid regime and then the occupation. That isn't just for Gaza. That's also the settlers in the West Bank as well. It's really important that we recognize that's just the beginnings of what we've seen in Gaza. And we cannot let history again repeat itself. We've had a very stark warning recently with what's been happening in Gaza. I think more widely, I keep being asked about Andy Burnham, for instance. He's on manoeuvres, and he was asked just this week whether he preferred Ed Davey or whether he preferred me. And he said he was somewhere in the middle. And I think this is the constant triangulation that we see from Labour leaders. And I almost think it doesn't matter who leads the Labour Party. And the reason why is because the Labour Party have been so corporate captured at this point that, one, they'll never let a left-wing leader be a leader again. They won't allow them to get into power. And two, even if they were in power, so much of their donations are from oil and gas companies, private healthcare, arms trade companies, gambling companies. And so those Labour politicians, whoever they are, and there are some good Labour politicians, but there's very few of them, but the majority of them are taking vested interests and donations. And so they're doing what they've been bought and paid for to do. And that is in the Labour culture now. So for me, kind of changing who's at the top of the organisation is interesting in terms of what direction and what tone do they go in. But in terms of making a material difference, particularly on something as stark as a genocide, Labour aren't going to cut it. And that's why when I became the leader of the Green Party, I said I'm not here to be disappointed by Labour or concerned or worried about what they're doing. I'm here to replace them. And if that sounds far-fetched, we've seen Reform do it. Reform have done it to the Conservatives. Kemi Badenoch almost does not get talked about. She's become so irrelevant to British politics because she's a soft version of what Reform are doing. So if that's your politics, why wouldn't you vote for Reform? And then we have a Labour Party where Donald Trump says one thing, Nigel Farage does it the next day or says it the next day, and then Keir Starmer legislates for it, you know, a week later. So if Reform can rocket through the polls with the politics of despair, the politics of division, the politics of toxicity, my absolute mission is to do the same thing on the left, but with the politics of hope, the politics of community, politics of peace and justice, and I believe that's absolutely something that people in this country are crying out for.
So you mentioned Reform surging in the polls and really kind of replacing the Conservatives and aspects of the Labour Party as well. Right. They're currently polling at 30-35%. There's discussions that they may even, like Farage may be the next PM. I personally don't think he actually has enough momentum, but you know, who knows about these things. At the same time, Reform in 2024 had 9 council positions. Now they've got more more console positions than you guys. You have 876 or thereabouts, and they have 886. How do you contain Faraj?
I think we have to recognize what it is that's driving Faraj. And I think back to that far-right march that we just had on the streets. It was like a who's who of the far right. We had Tommy Robinson, Katie Hopkins, Nigel Farage, people who I would say are absolute charlatans. They know exactly what they're doing. And they are often breeding working class resentment about austerity. And then they're combining it with this kind of odd alignment of the super elites trying to foster forces together to point at each other so they're distracting from them. I think that's very different from the people who are marching. Now, I imagine that if you were racist in this country, you'd absolutely do everything you could to be at that march. So when I hear politicians say the people marching aren't racist, I think that's a deeply problematic thing to say. I think a lot of people knew exactly what they were doing, and I think there's a lot of insidious racism in this country that is becoming more transparent, more explicit. I also think in the same breath, there's lots of people in this country who aren't racist, but feel so let down by establishment politicians, so let down by decades of conservative austerity and now Labour austerity. They might have voted for Labour because they wanted change, but actually what they've got, the two-child benefit cap, disability cuts, more money to the arms trade, a sense that like they're going for economic growth, but this economic growth is always for multimillionaires and billionaires. Keir Starmer talks constantly about tricky decisions, but they're always tricky decisions for working class communities. They're never tricky decisions for multimillionaires and billionaires. And so I can understand why people get to a place where they are so disenfranchised with the old two-party system, they're looking for something different. I think a lot of people see Nigel Farage and don't actually know what Nigel Farage represents. I went to Clacton on the first day that I was Green Party leader because I thought I could go somewhere where everyone agrees with me, or I could go into the Lion's Den where people are probably going to disagree with me. And conversation after conversation, when I talked about Nigel Farage's voting record, his stripping back of employment rights, the corporate donations he's taken from oil and gas companies, that's 95% of their donations, £2.1 million, people were shocked and horrified. Now, I'm not being disingenuous. I didn't have people going, okay, great, now I'm pro-migration. But what I did have is them questioning very quickly who Nigel Farage was and if reform really have their best interests. I think for those of us who are progressive politicians and more widely in the progressive movement, we have to have a relentless effort to expose Nigel Farage, to expose reform and everything that they stand for, so people can see them for the grift as they are. But it's not enough just to reject them. We also need to have a very positive vision, a very tangible difference that's going to make a material difference to people's lives. And that of all of the things is the fundamental thing here. If we can lower people's bills, if we can make them feel like there isn't as much scarcity in their life, they're not as worried and scared. I'm not saying racism will go away. I don't think anyone should be that naive. But I think the divisions and toxicity would greatly decrease. And I think politicians would be able to actually communicate with people as adults, where we listen both ways, rather than chasing the tail of Nigel Farage constantly, which is what's spiraling the toxicity in our politics.
So between, you mentioned that people are disillusioned with the two-party system. Between 2010 and 2019 in general elections, the two parties got between 65 and 75% of the vote. In the last election, they just got 57% of the vote. The Greens did really well, the Lib Dems did better than expected, and Reform also did well, just in terms of the representative vote. You've discussed before that there needs to be reform around first past the post. How do you think that's going to change coalition building? And how do you, what's your plans to make sure it actually gets done?
Well, it's massively important because Keir Starmer won with 33% of the vote and won all of that majority. That was a problem when it happened with Keir Starmer, and I want to be really clear about that. But the problem is even more stark if it happens with Nigel Farage. We have to be clear that Nigel Farage could get between 20 to 30% of a vote, probably more like 25 to 30% of a vote, and have a huge majority. Despite the fact that the vast majority of the country would oppose what he stands for, the broken voting system would allow that to happen. The first past the post voting system, by the way, it's only the UK and Belarus that use it in Europe, and one of them is literally a corrupt dictatorship, although both of them, you could argue, are going in the wrong direction. The way to kind of get it is coalition building, is to demand right now that whoever the future Labour leader is signs up to proportional representation in the same way that their members of the trade unions have. Ed Davey, I've criticised him in this interview, but the Lib Dems have always been solid on proportional representation. And I'm really pleased to hear Jeremy Corbyn, at least I think I've probably heard Zara Sultana say it, but I've certainly heard Jeremy say it, that in their platform they will also support proportional representation. More crucially than all of these politicians, though, the majority of the country recognising that the voting system is broken. And when Keir Starmer won the leadership on the coattails of Jeremy Corbyn, he has ditched every single pledge pretty much that he made then. And one of his pledges was that the first past the post voting system was broken. So to see him now saying it's not a priority is the deepest cynical politics, which I think ironically adds to the general malaise. They're both first for past the post causes because people go, well, my vote doesn't count. It's a broken system, so what's the point of voting anyway? To the fact that we need people to recognise that every single vote does matter, and whether you get the MP you want or not, the fact that you put that, you know, put your tick or cross on a ballot paper and say this is what I believe in, when all of those votes are added up, that really matters in and of itself. There's also a bit more niche, something called short money, which means every vote that a party gets in the country means they get a significant amount of money afterwards to essentially do policy development. And so the Green Party, one of the reasons we're doing so well right now, is we got significantly more short money because we stood in every seat of the last election.
Okay, earlier on you mentioned you're quite an unapologetic leader. It's very clear, I was just seeing your previous interviews and getting ready for this interview and even listening to you, it's very clear you have lots of clarity, what seems like ethical and moral clarity on your issues, and you're kind of very, very clear and direct. And I've mentioned earlier also, we're living in this soup in the next sort of decade or so, where British politics fundamentally may change away from the two primary parties that have led Britain for the last century, more or less. How do you see, if the landscape changes, do you think your role, specifically as Zach Polanski, but also the Green Party's role, may change and shift in the next election? You'll be talking about coalitions already. There could be new parties being spawned. How do you see that all working out?
I think I have a crucial role to play, and the Green Party have a crucial role to play. And just to put this in perspective, when I ran for leader of the Green Party, I knew it was an important role, but I thought it was going to be a much more important role in a few years' time. So I wanted a little bit of time to kind of bed in, to establish myself before we got into what felt like the kind of really dangerous, but also huge opportunities in the politics about where the world is facing, about where the world is heading. But actually, I think we're already at that place. I think I was at that place a couple of days after I got elected. I don't think anyone foresaw how much attention the Green Party would get, how many members we would get, how much press coverage I've had. In my first couple of weeks alone, I did over 200 national interviews. Now, the reason why that matters is it's not about me being interviewed, but it's about the politics that I'm putting on the table. I really very specifically remember a moment in my first week in a Sky News interview where I was asked about immigration, and the whole framing of the question was that migration is a problem and how am I going to reduce migrants? So I just batted it back with the fact that I welcome migration to this country. Migration is a really important thing in this country, both because we have 150,000 vacancies in the NHS. Of course, we've got to train British workers, but also that's not going to happen overnight, and people are making an amazing contribution. To the fact that our country is built on a problematic history of empire and colonialism, but also a beautiful history and more recent history of culture, art and music coming from all over the world. But more importantly than the jobs gap, more importantly than the culture that's brought, just basic humanity. The fact that if someone comes over here because they're fleeing for their life or are just looking for a better life as an economic migrant, then I think it's sensible and smart politics and kind and compassionate politics to welcome people here, because we know migration is circular. If you don't freak out about it, people come and people leave. So I said roughly this on Sky News. The journalist did not know what to say back to me. And that's because the whole frame of the discussion has been so repetitive that they always know what the next question is based on what the politician says. Now, this is just one example, but I'm having it over and over again where I'm going into mainstream media spaces with a different narrative and a different frame, and I'm seeing journalists have to work hard. Now, that's important, but the much more important thing is then when they turn to a politician from another party and put their frame to me, you are literally changing the conversation. Now, I'm not naive. I'm against very powerful interests, including GB News, a literal propaganda channel for reform. And they have deep pockets, so it's an uphill battle in terms of changing the conversation. But I'm also in no doubt that it's already starting to happen. And so what I see in the coming weeks and months is accelerating this process of making sure that we're changing that frame, that the public are changing that frame. And I'd also say here, without it being a shameless plug, I've set up a podcast, Bold Politics, went to number 3 in the country in the first week that I launched it. The reason why that matters is a journalist said to me recently, are you trying to avoid scrutiny by setting up your own podcast? I said, it's quite the opposite. Anytime anyone wants to interview me, I will come to your microphone and I will talk about the things you want to talk about. But I also recognize present company very much accepted, but lots of the media have a very particular agenda where they don't care what your agenda is, they just want to talk to you about migration. And so what I've done by setting up a podcast is say, actually, these are the things I want to talk about. And I'll talk about your things too. But actually, I think it's really important that the left and progressive politicians set their own agenda, because for far too long, we've been chasing the right-wing agenda. And it's time for new voices, new platforms. And I think that's starting to happen already.
Okay, we're going to get back to migration and multiculturalism, which you've spoken about a bit later in the interview. But I just want to speak a bit about you.
Sure.
So your family kind of hid their Jewish name initially when arriving in the country for the first few years of your life. As well, just speak a bit about to that. Speak about, you know, about your Jewish ancestry, what it was like coming to this country as a migrant. You know, you're from Manchester, which has a history associated with working class families. Just give us a bit of insights into that and how that kind of has defined who you are.
I'll caveat this all with my family ancestry is quite complicated, and that's a common Jewish experience because they were always on the run. But from little pieces I picked up just from the internet and message boards and talking to family, kind of my great grandparents were in a Jewish town in Latvia. There was almost a majority Jewish, I think pretty much unanimously. They ran because of pogroms and they ended up in Ukraine. More pogroms, they ended up in Poland. Then because of the Nazis, they arrived in the UK. Now, I found out that my family had changed their surname from Polden to Polanski. It turns out it might have been Polinski. Again, it's because it's complicated in terms of the written documents. But I presume that happened in Poland around the time of the Nazis. When I became a teenager, I found out it was actually to evade anti-Semitism in this country. And that really hit me as a 17, 18-year-old, the idea that my family would come here, and we often, me included, say this country has a proud history of immigration. We talk about the kinder transport, and I think sometimes we can give it rose-tinted spectacles. We know that there were signs on doors that said no blacks, no migrants, no Irish, no dogs. And the same thing happened to Jewish people as well. And so I changed my name back because I felt it's important to find pride in your identity. And actually the real kind of pride is when you don't feel shame anymore and you say, actually, I'm gonna own this identity. In terms of growing up in Manchester, I went to a Jewish school. I grew up in a Zionist household. So it's definitely been a journey in the last few years. The kind of key moment that changed things for me was I met an organization called Breaking the Silence. So they're a group of former IDF soldiers who are speaking out against the atrocities in Israel. This was even October 7th, but talking about the occupation. And I sat down with them and listened to them, and I just felt like instinctively as I was listening to them, I just didn't want to hear it. And a real kind of strong sense that I wanted to shut the conversation down. And it's a feeling I very rarely feel. We talked about being unapologetic, and I also pride myself on being able to listen to views that I disagree with too. And so I really had to go away and question what made me so uncomfortable. And I thought, it's because I know every single word they're saying is right. And of course, I know it all aligns with everything I've ever heard and seen and just didn't want to see. Now, someone can blame me for that and say, that's ridiculous. Why didn't you arrive sooner? But what I would encourage people, whether they're talking to Jewish people or whoever they are, we're all on the journey we're on. And we can push people away for not getting to the right or moral stance as quickly as we can. Or we can reach out the hand of friendship and say, it's really difficult if you've grown up believing one thing to be presented with evidence that really challenges your worldview. And actually, I think if we had more openness and curiosity in the world more generally on any political issue, we'd have better politics and more peace in the world.
Just out of interest, it's not to sort of criticize how long your journey may have taken, but just when did you actually come into contact with Breaking the Silence, and how has your family responded to your thoughts, but also to what's unfolding in Gaza?
Yeah, so I'm always careful not to talk about my family, but the other second half of the question, around about 2021, which is when I was first elected to the London Assembly, lots of people ask meetings for you when you first get elected. And I just thought, I'm going to take every meeting I can. If people want to talk to me, unless they're a big business or someone who's trying to lobby me for money, I'm going to have this conversation. And they were the noticeable difference, because a lot of the meetings I had were very London focused and London specific. Whereas their kind of invitation was, we're in London for a couple of days. Do you want to meet with us? And I thought, sure, I'll meet with you. And they were really, really powerful speakers. I should say, though, that sometimes in politics we can romanticize narratives, and it's not that I wasn't already having these ideas or I wasn't already asking questions. I guess I was just a lot more quiet about my advocacy for Palestine before that. I was already having doubts about the way I'd been raised and also asking questions, and I'd been to a few Palestine meetings. But I think it was meeting them that it was crystal clear when the meeting ended that actually I needed to use my platform and my microphone not to just not oppose the occupation, but actually go, what can I do from now to start speaking out against the occupation.
So before you got involved in politics, you were an actor and a hypnotherapist. Just any fond memories from that period?
Yeah, being a theatre actor was one of my favourite jobs I've ever had, and I love being leader of the Green Party. But also, I really, really loved those days. I was a community theatre actor, so I was doing something called Theatre of the Oppressed. Now, this started before I was born in the 70s. In the favelas in South America. They're working with some of the poorest communities, particularly with communities who are having troubles with landlords, police, or state violence. And what they would do is gather these people together and rehearse scenes of oppression to say next time, what could we as a community do differently to challenge our oppression? They call it rehearsing the revolution. So when I came along, we were starting to do this in London. And actually, this was one of the early times, this was about 10, 15 years ago, that I was working with former IDF soldiers and former Palestinian combatants to work together to talk about actually how could we broker a peace through art and drama. So there were both groups of people who said we want to leave the violence behind and we want to look at how we can start to use art and culture to find common ground. And I did 3 days of it, I think, with Amnesty International and a group called Cardboard Citizens who work in London with homeless people. And that was definitely one of my first big experiences of saying this story is a lot more complicated than the stories I've been told. It was very difficult in the room. These groups of people, despite giving up arms and saying we want to move towards peace, did have lots of conflict in the room for completely understandable reasons. And the truth also was, you know, I was in my 20s back then. I just didn't have the information to know who I agreed with, who I understood. I just was there absorbing and listening it. But I think, you know, that's had a later impact in life. Anyway, so I was working with migrant communities, disabled people, the trans community and the LGBT community more widely, to look at how can they empower themselves to use their voice more widely. I really love that work and I still support people who do that. I got to a moment though where I've been doing it for years and I thought, no matter how much I help someone empower themselves, no matter how powerful their voice is, if they come from a group, and often it's intersectional, so a black woman for instance, and the systemic barriers are so high that they can't overcome them, then actually you can be the most articulate voice in the world. You need allyship to help remove those systemic barriers. And so that's how I ended up getting into politics. In terms of hypnotherapy, that was one of about 20 jobs I was doing. So I was also working on the streets, handing out yogurt pots. I was doing charity fundraising. I was working in a nightclub doing guest lists. I think this is a very common story for theater actors, that you say you're a theater actor, but you're actually doing about 15 to 20 different jobs just to make the rent. I was walking to work often because I couldn't afford the bus fare, for instance. And I don't say this as a sob story. I say this because I think it's a really common experience in the gig economy, that people have lots of different jobs. And whilst that's an unusual kind of beginning for a politician, I think hand on heart is the thing that's given me the most insight, the most kind of experience to empathize and be able to listen to people because I've done those jobs. People often say to me, politics must be really stressful or difficult. And I'm like, try working in a cafe when you're really tired, you've been working 12 hours, you need to remember 5 orders and someone's shouting at you. That's a much more difficult job. So I think hospitality doesn't get the shout out it deserves.
So just a bit more about your life before politics. The Daily Mail, and I'm sure you know what's coming now, the Daily Mail keep on, you know, since your rise to prominence, they keep on talking about how you were a Harley Street hypnotist, right? That spoke, that had this theory where you could make women's breasts bigger by hypnotherapy. Just what's your response to why do you think they keep on bringing this up? But also, what's your response to the whole saga?
Well, the first thing is the story's bollocks. as a Sun journalist, someone said to me recently, you can't work for the Sun and be a journalist. Both things can't be true. But that was my first mistake, was taking a phone call from a Sun journalist. And they said, you're doing lots of work on body image, which I was doing in drama schools and universities, working with people just in group circles, kind of talking about what it feels like to feel good about yourself. Again, I was working as an actor, so public speaking training, those kinds of things. And they said, would I do an article about body image? And I said, sure. And then they said to me, would I do this ridiculous idea? And I said, absolutely not. That's not something I do and it doesn't work. And they said, would you be willing to do it as an experiment? I think people would be really interested and it would bring a spotlight to your work. And I said, as long as you make it clear, it's not something I charge for, it's not something I do, it's not my service. They then, to be fair to them, wrote the loveliest article about me that said I can do it, apparently, news to me, and I charged £220 for it. And I've apologised for it, and I think the important thing here is I apologised the next day. So it's not like I waited, it's 13 years later now, until I was a politician. This was well before I was a politician. I went out on BBC Radio and I said, this article does not represent me. The reason why I got involved with this is this for body image, let's talk. In terms of the Daily Mail attacking me, I think there's someone much more significant, which is Keir Starmer in the Labour Party. So when Kemi Badenoch became leader of the Conservative Party, despite what is awful, often right-wing rhetoric, Keir Starmer tweeted out to congratulate her on her success. When Nigel Farage became an MP, Keir Starmer made a point of crossing the chamber to shake his hand. When I became leader of the Green Party, I was doing an interview with BBC News 5 minutes after I'd won. And they said to me, did you know that the Labour government or the Labour press office have just tweeted out about this old story from you 12 years ago? I said, no, I didn't. They said, how does that make you feel? And I'm so glad that I didn't have time to think about it. But my genuine, honest answer was, I'm absolutely delighted because it shows they are so rattled. They are so scared because they know that the Green Party has a leader that can take the party to new heights, that we are mobilising, that we are organising in our community, and the Labour Party can no longer turn to the left and say, you have nowhere to go. The reason why the Labour Party are attacking me relentlessly and the Daily Mail are joining in is because they know that left-wing politics in this country now has a vehicle for change. It has a place that is going places where members are growing, we are winning elections, and that's how we're going to turn the country around. And nothing scares the establishment more.
When you compare, I mean, we've spoken about how the landscape, the political landscape in the UK is changing, but when you compare the issues that you were passionate about 10 years ago when you started, or a bit more, 11 years ago when you started getting into politics, as opposed to now, a lot of them are obviously similar, but they've also changed. What then were the kind of key things that you cared about, and how, and what are the key things you care about now?
My politics has completely changed on the superficial level, if I'm honest. I think much more deeply, my politics of compassion, wanting to connect with people, wanting to community organise, those have been completely consistent. And I think those are what really matter, actually, someone's values. I think the climate crisis is the most obvious one. When I was, when I was 18, 19, if you'd even asked me who the leader of the opposition was, I wouldn't have had a clue. I was so disinterested in politics. And then when I was doing the theatre work I just described, people would often say to me, oh, you should get involved in politics, or who are you voting for? And again, just totally uninterested. I felt like politics was a kind of dirty thing. We were doing politics as community theatre, but I just didn't recognise it as that. I thought, we're doing the important community work, and politics is the thing that doesn't really make a difference. Slowly I start to get more interested as I'm meeting more and more people. But the big thing that changed for me was in 2018, I went to an event that Extinction Rebellion was holding. Now I kind of had a, I wouldn't say explicitly, but a kind of cautious snobbishness about Extinction Rebellion. Just didn't really feel like my crowd, and I was interested in what they were doing for the theatre of it. But it didn't feel like serious politics to me, and the Green Party before 2017 hadn't felt to me like a party that was serious about winning power or changing things. And once I got more involved in politics, I really wanted to go, okay, how are we going to win things? I think that was really unfair of me. Now I recognise what the Green Party were doing. And I often say to Natalie Bennett, who was the leader of the Green Party at the time, you know, why weren't you talking about proportional representation? That was a big thing. They really mattered to me. And she said, we used to get 10 seconds on the media. Like, am I going to talk about the climate crisis or the cost of living crisis? Or am I going to talk about this obscure voting system that no one understands? And I think that's totally fair. I think things have changed now. It's not an obscure voting system. People bring it up without you even mentioning it. But I think that was probably the right tactic back then. Natalie Bennett was also incredible in the 2015 debates, where she stood up and spoke for the Syrian refugees. I think it was the first time that I'd ever seen a mainstream politician, it was definitely the first time, talk about the conflict in Syria and the fact that so often through our foreign interventions, whether it's in Syria, Yemen or Afghanistan, the amount of refugees that were being caused directly through the arms that we are selling to those countries where we're exacerbating the wars and the conflicts that are already happening. Anyway, 2018, I meet Extinction Rebellion. I'm just curious about what they're doing. And I go to what's called a People's Assembly, where groups of people gather together to just listen. And I'd say within 5 or 10 minutes, I'm absolutely captivated and hooked. It's the first time outside of doing community theatre where it suddenly felt like there was a flat structure. People were being listened to. Everyone's opinions were valid. And it just felt like a different kind of politics. And I'd already experienced that to some extent in the Green Party, because I joined 2 years before that in 2017. Or sorry, a year before that in 2017. So those things were already bubbling up, but I really felt it with Extinction Rebellion. And then my most obvious memory is a couple of hours later, literally the same first day as Extinction Rebellion started, being with my cousin, and I'm leading a chant because I've got carried away with what's going on in the day, and I've been listening to stories about the climate crisis and evidence about how we're one of the most nature-depleted countries in the world. And I'm chanting, and the police, about 200 police, maybe even more, all come in formation and start to walk towards us. And by this point, I'm leading the chanting. My cousin turns to me and she says, we should probably step back, like, you've not come here to get arrested. And all the people who were there to be arrested had been on training courses. They knew what to do if they got arrested, what to say if a police officer put you in handcuffs. I hadn't been on any of those training courses because I was so absolutely convinced that I wasn't going to be arrested. And I think it was just real a life moment where I remember those police kind of making a beeline for me because I was the loudest chanter. My brain just went, this is it. You either believe in these things or you don't. Are you willing to lose your freedom right now for the things you care about, the evidence you've just heard and the people you're standing with? Or are you going to take a stance where you take a step back? Now, I want to be cautious about this. Some people take a step back because they're black or Asian, and their relationship with the police are going to be a very different relationship to my police, to my relationship with the police. So that's not condemning anyone who doesn't do that. But I also had a moment where I thought, my freedom right now cannot be more important than the thing I'm standing for. And so I was arrested and taken to a cell. And none of it was premeditated. None of it was thought through. Absolutely felt like the right thing to do, and I'm really proud that I did it. And I also feel that about Palestine Action right now and the prescription of Palestine Action. Someone asked me recently if I would be willing to go to prison over Gaza. And it's not a question I'd thought about before, and without even thinking, I said, yes, of course I would. Now, I don't anticipate that happening because I'm the leader of a political party and I've got lots of avenues and platforms, so I don't need to chain myself to railings, sit on roads, or glue myself to roads. But I wouldn't condemn for a second people who do that. I think they're some of the bravest people in the country who are saying we are willing to put ourselves in the line of danger to lose our freedom because these things matter and politicians are failing us. I'd obviously say one to those people, some politicians aren't failing you and join the Green Party because we're absolutely by your side. But two, much more importantly, thank you for everything you do because the two-party broken system is failing them, and that's why we need to widen out our politics.
How important do you think Gaza is in terms of trying to capture just what's wrong with British politics, and what has it exposed? I mean, it's all of us know that it's kind of exposed massive amounts of hypocrisy. It's shown us how, you know, leaders are so subservient to corporate interests. But for you, what do you think, why do you think there's this massive disconnect between people and the population and the voters and the way the government, the UK government, but governments around the world in the Western world have dealt with this issue?
I think there's two questions there, which is how important is it politically and how important is it ethically in terms of reflecting the political system? Politically, my honest answer, and it makes me really sad to say this, is not as important as it should be. We see poll after poll that actually what people really care about is the cost of living crisis. And that's why as Green Party leader, I focus everything I say initially on lowering people's bills, bringing water companies back into public ownership. It's outrageous that they're pumping sewage into our water and charging us extra for the privilege. Without a doubt, there are a lot of people in this country who really care about Gaza and care about the genocide. But the fact that it's not everyone, I think, is a shocking indictment of political education in this country and the failure of much of the media to report accurately about the atrocities that are happening both in Gaza but around the world more generally. Ethically, I think, is a very different question. It matters hugely because I think it goes to the very heart of the corruptions of vested interests. The fact that the Labour government, just before the general election, took £4.1 million from Quadrature Capital. They're a hedge fund that have assets based in arms trade, oil and gas, gambling companies. Keir Starmer didn't do anything illegal, but he did claim it in the exact window where you wouldn't need to tell people that you've claimed it until after the general election. So people voted without him knowing that he'd taken that money. Just this week, Labour conference, they've been sponsored by an actor. So this is another asset fund, which is links with arms and trade. With an arms trade company that are aiding and abetting the genocide in Gaza. So not only are they complicit, not are they enabling it, they are taking money from it. We saw them celebrating just this week investments they've made with Palantir, which we also know are a deeply problematic company, both in terms of technology, our civil liberties, but also military so-called defense for the Israeli Defense Force. And so we've got a government that are that brazen, that not only are they not challenging the genocide, they're actively doing business with it. And I think the reason why this matters is because it all adds to the general malaise in this country between where the public are and where Westminster establishment politicians are. And it is important to say, and I'm not contradicting myself here, although it might sound initially, that when you ask people about the genocide in poll, the majority of the country, unsurprisingly, oppose it. And there's never been a bigger gap between where the public are on an issue and where the establishment are on an issue. The problem is, although they oppose it, they don't oppose it enough to care about it to change their vote. That confuses me. Sometimes as a politician, you want to claim you've got all the answers. Sometimes when I go to community meetings where they're not talking about it, I think, how are we having any other conversation right now other than what is happening every single day, where there's been genocides in the past, but this is the first one we've seen live streamed on our phone screens, on our TV screens. But it's not my job as a politician to tell people what they need to care about. It is my job, though, to create the moral argument, to shine a spotlight on what's happening, and to hold these politicians to account. So to summarize, it really matters. And I think it does matter to a core group of people. It matters more than anything else. But what hasn't broken through yet is this isn't the number one conversation in the country. And we get back to the distraction techniques. I think it's not the number one conversation in the country. I'm not blaming anyone. But if you're struggling to put food on your table or heat in your homes or get to work, that's when you start to hear why you're worrying about something that's happening on the other side of the world rather than right here. But we know it's the inequality that is both causing people not to be able to have food on their home, where that money is also being siphoned off to private interests. So all of these things are inextricably linked, and you can't have environmental justice without racial, social, and economic justice too.
You mentioned earlier, just speaking about immigration, you mentioned earlier that when you used to appear on mainstream media, especially after you became the Green Party leader, the question was, you know, what are you going to do to stop it, instead of discussing whether immigration is actually a good thing for the country or not. Polling seems to suggest again that the population has increasingly become, you know, more suspicious of immigration. What would your argument be beyond, you know, multiculturalism is cool? What would your argument be to convince them that immigration is, you know, an answer and is great and can be managed in a very constructive way?
I don't think we're ever going to win the argument on immigration by just focusing on immigration, because actually what happens is you eventually appease something. We just keep shifting to the right. We're seeing that this week with indefinite leave to remain. The fact that Nigel Farage has even put this on the table as a national conversation will worry so many people in this country who will already be looking at leaving, both because they feel forced to and they're scared, or because they think, screw you. Like, why would I buy a house here? Why would I invest my family here, you know, if you don't even want me here? And so rather than have Keir Starmer get outside number 10 and say that in really, you know, certain terms, we've got Shabana Mahmood and Keir Starmer ultimately saying, oh, we'll move indefinite leave to remain from 5 years to 10 years. That's just throwing red meat to Farage and to well, racists, let's call them what they are. And moving it from 5 to 10 years is not going to appease them. They're just going to demand more and more and more. So on immigration, unless you present your alternative vision for immigration, you're never going to win. So what is that alternative vision? Well, the first thing is to raise people's living standards. Again, we keep coming back to the same point, but if people can put heat in the home, food on the table, and feel secure, I think the idea that an immigrant is a problem starts to drift away, because actually they're not worried about scarcity, they're not worried about the lack of social homes, or the lack of being able to get an NHS dentist, or the lack of feeling like the country is quote unquote too full, because they feel happy and fulfilled in their lives. I don't think people who are happy and fulfilled look to blame other people, they just get on with being happy. I think the second thing is to stop the small boats. I want to stop the small boats as well, but we can stop them through safe and legal routes. We know that this is a manufactured crisis. In 2016, partly around Brexit, they decided to shut down the asylum processing centres so they could create an asylum backlog, so they could point at asylum seekers and say, look, they're the problem. There's absolutely no reason to be putting people in hotels. There's certainly no reason to be putting people in hotels and giving very, very expensive contracts to multimillionaires and billionaires to make more money while leaving people in absolute crap conditions. This is scandal upon scandal upon scandal. But the scandal is not people who are fleeing for their lives. The scandal is a government who have cynically and opportunistically looked at how they can make a business opportunity out of scapegoating these people while lining their own pockets. That's all deeply depressing and needs to be called out. And then finally, I think it is making the economic arguments for migration. Now, I do these carefully because I think the multicultural arguments are actually the more important ones. But there is very, very clear evidence that someone who lives in this country as a migrant is more likely to be paying more in tax to the country than they are taking out in benefits. If you use the National Health Service, the person who treats or cares for you is more likely to be a migrant than anyone in front of you in the queue. So I think there's stats, there's data that are very clear about the benefits of migration. But again, I don't often lean into the economic arguments because I think it's seeding ground that actually the biggest reason to accept someone's humanity in this country is because we're human beings. And I think the vast majority of people in this country, when they feel safe and secure, lean towards compassion, lean towards justice and fairness. And I think if you can convince people that you just want a fair, managed approach to migration, that's something that most people can get on board with. We've just not had that approach for a long time. We've had chaos and we've had constant appeasement to the right.
What do you think? I mean, we've spoken a lot about a disconnect between the people and the establishment or political elites or corporate interests. Other than, you know, the self-serving argument that they're just selfish and they're kind of looking after themselves, what do you think is at the heart of the blind spot that, that the establishment has?
I don't think it's a blind spot. I think it's self-serving. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I think some of them got into politics to do exactly this, and they're doing what they wanted to. If that sounds abstract, there were literally hundreds of MPs right now, Labour MPs in particular, who were corporate lobbyists before they were MPs. So what I'm saying is not a stretch. They were doing a job where they pushed politicians through money and power to make the decisions they wanted because they were being paid to by big business. They've just removed the middleman. Now they are literally the politician who have the same links with those same management companies, and they're doing what they needed them to do. Less cynically, I think there are people who got into politics for the right reasons. They wanted to serve their communities, but very quickly they got used to the red carpets, or the champagne, or the dinners, or the freebies, and the lobbying, and they've just spiraled. And I think when you go into Westminster, and when they sit on those green benches, or when they walk into the halls of power, there are some notable exceptions. But for lots of people, you can see they're all part of the same club, and exactly what the public think about politics is often true. People are going to the same dinner parties. People are sharing the same briefings. They're trotting out the same lines. And it doesn't matter if they're Conservative or Labour, they are ultimately on the same page on so many issues. What's fascinating to see is Nigel Farage is often the disruptor. He's the one who is saying more what he thinks rather than just doing it for business. But the point is, he's saying what he thinks because he's enjoying creating the distraction and the disruption, because ultimately he wants to serve big business to line his own pockets. It's a different tactic, but it's doing the same thing in the end. I think what the Green Party can relentlessly cut through on is the fact we don't take money from unethical big businesses. We're not in vested interests. We have two vested interests. It's protecting people and it's protecting the planet. And when 90% of your donations are from membership fees, that means the only people I'm in hock to are the 80,000 members who are members of the Green Party, who are there to hold me to account when there's leadership elections, who are there to speak to me at conference to check that they're pleased with the job I'm doing. And I think that's when you get a better politics, when the MPs who are elected for those constituents are only there to serve their constituents rather than the big business who are putting money into political donations. And I do think lobbying is the next big scandal in this country, just like the blood scandal, the post office scandal, the amount that goes on around political lobbying. And I only know the surface is absolutely disgusting and is a poison that is eroding democracy and decency in this country.
I mean, I'm a non-Brit, so I'm an outsider. I've been living here for a while now. And when I see, you know, 100,000 people walking, marching through London, a lot of them saying racist chants and slogans, when I see the establishment kind of not, you know, being able to connect with the people or understand the issues, to me, it looks like just there's a lot of hang-ups over the fact that this was once a great empire, and now it's an economy which is hardly growing. What's your response to that?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I think that also links into the conversation about NATO and the conversation about security and defence across the whole of Europe. This so-called special relationship with Donald Trump. I mean, American imperialism has been a problem for a long time, and I'm not suggesting that other presidents have been fine. But with Donald Trump, the mask is well and truly off. We have a misogynist, a homophobe, a racist in the White House. And not only do we not call them out, we spend millions of pounds on an unprecedented second state visit to roll out a red carpet for a man who said he wanted to turn Gaza into luxury condos. I mean, we could talk about anything else in this interview. I could talk about lots of politicians that have made disastrous decisions and unethical decisions. And I almost feel like it's if you throw enough crap at the wall or flood the zone, as Donald Trump and Steve Bannon literally say, that's exactly what's happened here. Because this second state visit caused a little bit of a kerfuffle. A few people were annoyed. How was not pretty much every single person in this country saying, why is our money being spent on honouring a man who is this disgusting and this vile? Now, the caveat I put here is, do we need to have a relationship with the American president? Of course. He's been democratically elected. I think the American people beyond got the wrong choice, although I have huge issues with Kamala Harris too, but she was clearly the better choice. That's not up for me to decide as a British political leader. The Americans have cast their vote, and we have to work with whoever they voted for. So a diplomatic relationship based on trade deals, based on peace deals, that's really important, even with people you disagree with. But this kind of lavish honouring of someone who deserves to be shamed, not put on a pedestal, demonstrated how deeply problematic our so-called special relationship is with America. And I think what that speaks to around empire and colonialism is the exact conversations we've had around the flag. Now, if people want to wave a flag because they want to be patriotic or at a football game or because they're proud of their country, I think people are allowed to do that and they should be allowed to do that. I also think patriotism is caring about your local community, the park, caring about your neighbours. And so a care and love for the country is absolutely something I want to nourish and to flourish. But to see the Lib Dems, so Lib Dem MP Tim Farron, and today or this week, Keir Starmer, asking everyone to wave the flags, is such a disconnect with the conversation we need to be having in this country, which is not how do we wave the flag more, how do we demonstrate more patriotism. I think the question is how is our flag allowed to be hijacked with the narrative of empire and colonialism, that when so many minority communities, and obviously I can't speak for everyone, but lots of people I speak to, minority communities see those flags up on streets and feel fearful and feel terrified. Now, whether that's perceived fear or whether that's an actual fear because they've had a negative experience is almost a separate question, because without a doubt, people are feeling fear and they have legitimate reason to feel fear because there was the biggest far-right march there's ever been in this country on the streets very recently. And the Prime Minister and the political establishment don't seem to oppose it. So if that's happened and then you see these flags, you can understand how all of this is problematic. So to take a step back from this pretty depressing tale, I also think there's a big opportunity here, which is, I said Nigel Farage isn't a populist. He's not a patriot either. He claims to be a patriot. But patriots don't hate the country. Patriots don't go to America to slag off the country and to slag off free speech. Patriots don't look to give more money to big business and more money to water companies so that they can strip our assets away. Patriots don't want to do deals with foreign investors. Patriots don't see Donald Trump when he wants to put tariffs on us and refuse to criticize him because he's your best mate for whatever reason, or the fact that the American president is in the Epstein files and he just doesn't want to talk about it. None of that is patriotism. So I think the question then is, what is progressive patriotism? How do we reclaim that? How do we have a huge national conversation in this country that probably involves conversations about reparations, reconciliation with our history? What does it look like now when communities work together? And that's not about getting to some kind of utopia. Different communities will inevitably have tensions. That's what happens in our difference. And none of us should all be the same. But we also know when those differences are worked on with creativity, with love, with compassion, that's when better things come together, when that kind of fusion comes together. And we seem to have lost that discourse in so many much of our art, our culture and our politics. And I think it's a moment to recognize that we've gone so badly wrong, but that's also a moment to then turn it around.
Final question, and it's kind of related to what you've been speaking about in the last part of your previous answer, but what's your vision for the UK in the year 2050?
It's a huge vision. It's a vision of beautiful green spaces where people love being there, where they're public squares that haven't been sold off to private businesses. It's about what is the good life. We were promised we would work shorter hours and our wages would increase. The reverse has happened. People are working far too hard and not being paid properly. So it looks like a universal basic income. It looks like a place where we shatter this economic myth where a national economy is anything like a household budget. And once we've got rid of that idea of having to balance the books, it's where we're actually able to invest in our public spaces, in our public services, so we can have trains and buses that run on time, where we have cleaner air, where people have jobs, where we're doing all of these things, whether in the public sector, whether in a trade union, so that they know that they're going to be paid properly at work, that they have dignity and care. It looks like arts and culture, which is part of telling this vision, but also at the same time, it's not just telling very narrow stories of power and wealth, because the people who control the arts and culture are the people who tell the stories or commission the stories. But it's where we hear working class stories. It's where we hear stories of refugees and migrants, and stories that I can't even imagine right now because I've not even heard those stories. But those people get a platform to be able to tell those stories, so we're all constantly expanding our mind. It looks like a country where we still have problems, where inequality still exists, because I think it will always exist to some extent, but people have the power and agency to organize, so the inequality doesn't feel so overwhelming that you can do nothing about it and your politicians are all in it for themselves. It looks like a place where every single citizen knows that they have agency and empowerment, so that when they get together in their community and they organize, they know it won't be too long before things change. And actually they can kick that old politician out and one of them can be elected. So our future politicians look like the community. I'm really excited when I think about future Green MPs. They might not even have joined the party yet. They might join last week or even after hearing this interview, no subtle hint there. I also think that a new vision for what the country looks like is where we're not scared and terrified or paralyzed by the climate crisis, but actually we go in the same way that we set up the NHS after the Second World War. Right now we're in another crisis, but it doesn't have to be a crisis of sacrifice. It can actually be an opportunity where we invest in new jobs of renewable energy, of insulating every home in Britain that needs it, so it's cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter and can lower bills. Looks like community energy, where people own the solar panels and wind turbines in their area, so they get the money back and then they can choose how they spend it. And finally, it looks like on councils, when councils have a budget, we have participatory budgeting. So actually the people involved in the community can get involved in that budgeting and decide what are our priorities for the community. So they're not looking to politicians to make decisions for them. There's no us or them, there's just one us, because we're rebuilding community spaces. And I can think of little more that will change our towns, our cities, change our country, and ultimately I really do think that can change the world.
Zach Polensky, thank you so much. You definitely seem to have gotten the attention of the people in the cafe. So I hope you'll probably get the attention of our viewers. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not-so-unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfaq Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.